Hey there, it's Dane Reinhardt bringing you the President's Perspective, a conversation between current and future leaders of NAHU.
So this week's podcast, we're doing something different, but I think, again, an important part of this discussion that we've been having over the last year is different voices, different perspectives about our business. And today we're fortunate enough to be joined by Carson Kamenetz, currently a student at the University of Maryland, which is formerly in the Atlantic Coast Conference, but then somehow bailed. But I know, I think y'all had to pay the ACC like $80 million to get out, right?
Is that we were held hostage.
Convenient fiction.
And, you know, the fun part for me about that always was, and it's relevant to this conversation, I'm a Carolina grad. Of course, Dane is a graduate of the University of Virginia because they're like
NCAA lacrosse champions 2019-2021.
But one of the interesting things, my story prior to Virginia winning was prior to that, the only ACC team outside of North Carolina that ever won an NCAA championship was Maryland. And then y'all left the ACC. So then that was when, fortunately,
I never thought about that. So you had State, Carolina, and Duke all won NCAA basketball championship. Until Maryland won, no one had done it, and that Georgia Tech had never won it?
Nope. But anyway, Carson is currently a student at the University of Maryland, comes from a political family. His father's a former county executive of Baltimore, which is basically like the leader of the county, the way that, a mayor might be the leader of a city. And was actually running for governor as a Democrat in 2018 when his father passed away suddenly. Carson, obviously, is very interested in politics and been in his family blood. But I think it's an interesting conversation because, you know, Dane and I both come from, I think, what we would call Gen X. I think that's probably right. And you're probably more on the Gen Z side like my kids are. And so we get to, you know, look negatively at the millennials together. That's awesome for us. But I think the perspective of somebody who loves politics, maybe doesn't know a lot about healthcare, is really an interesting conversation for us to have because so many people in our business are our age or older, and they sometimes don't really know how to talk to anybody younger than them. But I think people struggle with talking to, you know, anybody younger about the reality of healthcare. And Dane and I both come from very similar backgrounds in that, you know, neither one of us showed up on the high school roster as most likely to be an insurance agent when we graduated from high school. But the business has been, I think, very interesting and very vital for what we do. So thank you for joining us. I think, again, trying to add voices and perspectives and just really appreciate you being willing to be on.
Yeah, David, thank you so much for having me on here. I'm definitely happy to have this conversation with you guys and I'm looking forward to it.
So one of the kind of very basic questions is, when you think about healthcare policy as someone who clearly your father was involved in it, something that clearly is going to play a role in what you will do in the future, I mean, what do you think is the future of healthcare policy in America?
So being, like you said, Gen Z, you know, involved with mainly millennials and those younger, I am constantly hearing that the system itself is flawed, that it's constantly geared towards profiting from those who are the sickest or oldest. And I feel like that's a frustration that's definitely become more mainstream recently. And it's definitely shared with people that are older or more poor. But I think that the coronavirus and the pandemic is going to shift that. I think that the main concern that the people I've spoken to, people in Gen Z or millennials have, is that we're so used to instant results and, you know, instant gratification, and because our attention spans have become so short from the smartphone technology and that entire new atmosphere. The pandemic, by providing things like telehealth and drive-through processes, kind of enables that for people my age. It's something quicker. So instead of maybe just Googling symptoms and going to WebMD, you know, we can have more faith in the system and go through the process faster and maybe paperless or something without, you know, going into the office and having to put down a copay and wait in the office. And so I think the pandemic, although awful, has definitely opened up a lot of opportunities for that. And I definitely see that as the future. I don't know about you guys. You're probably more aware than I am, but that's my perspective.
I think with the pandemic, you're right. And I also believe that the pandemic, what it did first and foremost, from a macro perspective, is it forced people that didn't want to change to have to change. Like, you didn't have a choice. Like, you couldn't do things. You were restricted by whether you wanted to go out, whether the restaurants were open, whatever it is. And your access to healthcare became limited and only on a very acute basis. So anything elective was pushed off. The ability, if you were an adult, you were limited in the ability to have visitors in the hospital. And even if you were a minor, it was very, so everything changed in that sense. And there was that clear fear of early on how corona could be spread and all the unknowns in that environment. So I know your generation likes the instant, easy access to results and data. You know, we're currently in a system. You spoke to a couple ends of the spectrum. At the young end of the spectrum, people like you tend to be on their parents' healthcare. That's been extended now to age 26 for most. And then on the other end of the spectrum, people fall into the government under the Medicare rolls when they turn 65. So you've got from 27 to 65, call it, that are predominantly on an employer-based healthcare access to their health insurance. Not exclusively, I mean, there's legislation, regulations changed over time that's made individual personal health insurance more accessible. It's not underwritten the way it used to be. So it's easier to get, but I don't mean to put you terribly on the spot, Carson, but what are your thoughts on, say, over the next 5 to 20 years on where you might see the deliverable? Like, how do you see if the majority of those folks in that middle that I spoke about are getting their healthcare from their employer, and then you look at other countries, most other countries in the world don't do that, don't do it that way. The UK, Canada, two of the ones that are most obvious, have some sort of government run health plan that's taking care of all the people in the country. So it's not a simple unwind. If you have a thought on that, that would be interesting.
Yeah, so I'm a little familiar with Kissick's triangle of healthcare, where he focuses on access, cost, and quality, and argues that it's really difficult to maintain all three and improve all three. So I think when focusing on a government system, we have to do what can benefit the most people the best way possible. And we see with the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, it increases access, of course, but that either costs a lot of money, which it does, or it reduces the quality or increases wait times or whatever may have you. So I think we definitely need to see some sort of balance in that triangle, whether it's decreasing access or increasing access at the cost of more money or reduced quality or increased wait times. It's all about finding a balance. And I know some argue that that triangle can really be turned into a square and throwing choice in there. But I think when focusing on a government system, I think choice is kind of difficult to throw into that equation. So yeah, it's just finding the balance between access, cost, and quality. I think, like you said, other countries, I know countries like Denmark have a universal system, but their wait times are definitely longer than those here. So there are definitely ups and downsides to whichever of the three in the triangle that you choose to focus on.
And it's interesting that you bring up the triangles. Awesome. But I think from our end, you're right. This business has changed a lot. And, you know, the ACA change some of the fundamental accessibility issues. But, you know, one of the things that I found interesting, and part of my background, I started my early 20s doing policy consulting for the Lieutenant Governor of North Carolina, and one of the first kind of attempts at healthcare reform during Clinton. And, you know, my politics swing more towards the Democrats, and I'm probably more of a classic social liberal. But one of the things that's been very interesting to me is that markets are strangely efficient. And competition actually plays a very interesting role. For example, people talk about how healthcare costs have gone up so dramatically because of the Affordable Care Act. But most of that's because prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, only a very few people could buy individual health insurance. Now anybody can buy it. Costs adjust. That's a part of the reason for the subsidies. Now we're starting to see the cost of those plans go down and competition go up. And so innovation comes from that. But it's hard to get past, you're right, that triangle. And it's interesting, you said it could be made into a square. Man, it could be made into an octagon, because behavioral economics is one of those very interesting aspects. People who don't know what the cost of something is, and all they know is what their copay is, will go wherever they need to go. And sometimes neither price nor quality nor access matter. It's only what they have to pay. And so, you know, that's the complexity of it is that healthcare is hard. But I want to go back to something you said a minute ago too, which is the perception of the system and how inefficient it is. And yet I think there's an aspect of COVID that really showed how it can be efficient and things can innovate quickly. Your point about telemedicine. There are so many people in medical providers' offices over the last 20 years who complained about how they couldn't do telemedicine, who suddenly within 6 weeks built the bandwidth, built the delivery mechanism, built the tracking mechanism, and got paid for it. And it's like, it only took a market reality for that to happen, right? Or, you know, creating a vaccine for COVID. I mean, you stop thinking about this 20 years from now, it took 14 months. There are strange efficiencies that are hard to get past. And I think that's one of the things I've struggled with explaining to policymakers. It's like, yes, nothing is perfect. Public systems are great. They cover 38% of people in America, but they're 50% of what's spent on healthcare. Right now, 61% of people who are covered on healthcare are covered on private systems, and those private systems account for about 47% of what's spent on healthcare. So it's efficiency, it's benefit design, and quality. I mean, I do think that perspective that you've got is really important.
Yeah, I mean, going back to your point about talking to policymakers, I think it's really difficult to, I guess, in your mind, tell them what is actually true and what's actually going on in the industry and how things are actually efficient. You know, like after the initial panic of COVID, how effective the system actually was. It's hard to explain when people are constantly seeing thousands of people are dying every day. You know, people are like, how can the system be so good? How can it be so efficient when we're seeing CNN tell me that 500,000 people have died? You know, so it's difficult to explain that. And I understand that and sympathize with that. But at the same time, it's from a policymaker perspective, it's about pleasing as many people as you can. So if most people are seeing, oh, people are dying, that means the system must be flawed or inadequate. That's the response that the policymakers are going to give.
It's a great point. You know, I think one of these conversations almost always drags into, as we've alluded to, single payer. And friends of mine who are to the left of me and to the right of me, and most of our friends that left of me start arguing with me about single payer systems and how carriers are evil. And it's again, one of those very interesting conversations that, you know, I'm sure you've run into some already as well, which is, in reality, Medicare and Medicaid in America are not run by the government. They're run by the carriers. It's just they have no motivation to keep it efficient like they do their commercial business. And so, you know, I think the more we have these conversations and honest conversations, I think that point you made a minute ago, Carson, is really important. Is how do we get into the in-depth conversations that get beyond the platitudes and the 30-second sound bites into really having meaningful change? To me, that's an interesting question to ask you and your generation, because I think y'all can change the way we talk about politics by actually having conversations.
100%. I think that younger people really need to be put into these positions of power and influence because they're more sympathetic and empathetic to how to fix these issues. They have experienced and seen a pandemic very early in our lives. We are already familiar with how healthcare works because of how much access we have to information. You know, we have so much information at our fingertips that we could learn and absorb. And I think that what you guys are doing is great. Having a podcast like this and allowing me, a younger voice, to come on is definitely beneficial, because this is how people really get their information now. I know every time I'm in the car, I'm listening to a podcast. All of my friends my age, they do the same thing. And this is the way to go. It's never a sports podcast. It's always something that they're interested about learning about, whether it be current issues or politics or healthcare like this. So the way to reach out to us is definitely this way. This is the way to go.
You brought up a really interesting, I mean, it's very elementary, Carson, but the statement you made from a policymaker's perspective, perception is reality. Reality doesn't matter. It's perception. So whatever's on CNN that night driving the news bit or whatever news channel you tend to watch, that's going to be what's going to be driving, it sounds like what you're saying, policymaker motivation. Is there any sense in your peer group? I hope we can agree that the sausage making process, especially in DC, is one that is just so broken in the process in and of itself, where something that seems common sense may not get through because or things get attached to bills all the time, you know, where there's foreign aid being thrown into a healthcare bill or whatever it is. Is there a sense on your in your generation, is there still sort of a two-party affiliation politically in that sense?
Oh, I think I'll call it partisan warfare for dramatics, but I think the bickering between the two parties, especially with those my age who are now getting in politics for the first time, who have so much access to information and social media, like which is completely new to the political spectrum and world, are constantly arguing about which side is correct, whether this news source is credible compared to this one. And I think that's definitely different in comparison to those who may be older, like yourselves, who may be more, I guess, okay with the status quo, understanding that the system is the system, whereas the younger people tend to be more radical in thinking that they can overthrow or fix the system. When in reality, you know, those who are more mature and who've lived life and had shared experiences understand that the system is the system, you know, and I think that that plays a major role in this partisan fighting. Because I really do think it's led by my generation. I think that younger and younger people are getting elected to Congress. You know, some of the biggest heads in both the Democratic and Republican Party are millennials, thinking of people like Congresswoman AOC, Congressman Crenshaw on the right, young voices that are taking front and center because they are telling other young people that they can fix the system and reform the system from the inside.
Yeah. I think there is that opportunity. I think every one of us, I mean, I've loved politics my whole life, and I always believe that you could affect change. I think the one thing that you get into it, and you saw this some data with your dad, and you already see it in what you're getting involved in now, you almost immediately understand that change happens, but its pace is never nearly as quick as you want it to be.
Right.
And the gap is not that people don't want to change, it's that people don't understand how what we're doing now doesn't work. And so you have to spend time getting them there.
And from a policy perspective, the system was set up for gridlock, for stagnation, for finding the best solution through compromise and thinking that you could just change something massive and just ram it through Congress because you hold the party is not really a sustainable way. So even though all these young people are so enthusiastic about change, it's the realization that it doesn't happen overnight needs to come quickly.
So I know you mentioned that you're running for the Central Committee this summer. I mean, kind of how does this look for you? How does this process look for you? Because I think it is interesting to think about the imbalance sometimes of being ambitious, but not too ambitious, right? I'm intrigued by that thought process, because I think it's important for also people to think about how we approach things and how we talk to people.
Right. So I am looking at the Democratic Central Committee for Baltimore County. And my thought process has been, I've been talking to people my age, and they feel like, especially in local politics, there is nobody speaking for them. There's nobody guiding them through this fighting happening on Annapolis as opposed to DC. So they are asking for a voice that can kind of mediate for them, that can explain to them what is going on. And I think by entering the Central Committee at such a young age, my responsibilities, of course, in Central Committee would be helping form the party platform, helping raise money for higher elected officials in the county and state. I think a young voice in there is definitely necessary in order to get young people involved in politics and get the ball rolling for the longstanding change that is absolutely necessary. That does not take overnight, like we just said. So it's definitely a process, and I'm looking at it. I got a year to decide, so it's close, but it should definitely be fun, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I mean, I think that's exciting. I think it's exciting to see, you know, about Dane's daughters. I've got a daughter who's 24 and one that's 21, and a son who's 21, and very different political perspectives between them, but both understand that need to be involved. And I think that's I think in my generation and even in the millennial generation, that really never felt like they should get involved. Whereas I feel like your generation feels like this great sense of responsibility to get involved, which I think is great news for us. So that's exciting.
Yeah, I agree. Moving back to healthcare, and I feel like younger people in these positions of power would really provide the sympathy that's so many people feel like is missing. And that's really what I think is important.
I do think you're right. I think every time you put a real store, people used to talk about people in our business made so much money in commissions. And I remember one of the first conversations I had with the member of Congress about that, sitting in a room, and I was like, hold on a second, let's go around the room and talk about, you know, how much we make on a 20 life group. It's not a car payment. And what you get to is this realization that most of us actually approach our jobs very much from a service mentality. We're helping people fix problems that they don't know how to fix. And I think that that mentality is an important part of what we do. I like that sympathetic perspective point, because I think it's critically important for what we do.
Well, thank you guys for being so sympathetic. I'm sure all your clients appreciate it.
Well, and we appreciate you taking time to be with us, Dane.
Yeah, Carson, thank you for coming on. Is there any way you want to know where people can find you? Maybe tell us a little about your podcast or any other ways you want people to find you.
So I was on a Baltimore Positive podcast a couple of weeks ago. I will have a website up in the future, but right now we're just getting a feel for everything.
Very good. Well, we'll circle back with you over time, catch up with you on the campaign and see how things are running.
And thanks for being willing to continue your father's legacy. I think it's an important thing, because I think the responsibility of leadership is hard, and I'm sure losing your dad was really hard, but I think he clearly inspired in you something great. And I think that's important. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.